Luke Groskin here. I produce videos for Science Friday, and we want you to watch them. Did you know that you can subscribe to our science videos? That's right. Just like the podcast you're listening to now, you can subscribe to get a weekly dose of Science Friday on video. Just head over to youtube.com/scifry. That's youtube.com/scifry, and click the subscribe button. It's that easy. Thanks for listening. Now on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Later this hour, you probably heard about Apple's iWatch announcement this week, but they also unveiled something called Research Kit. We'll take a closer look at what that kit does. But first, it's been nearly a year since the World Health Organization posted a short announcement about an Ebola outbreak in the forested areas of southeastern Guinea. The outbreak would eventually spread to neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone and infect over 24,000 people, killing 10,000. Liberia discharged its last known Ebola patient last week, and new infection rates have decreased. But the battle is not over. Just today, an American healthcare worker who contracted the virus in Sierra Leone arrived in the U.S. for treatment. What is the status of promising treatments for Ebola? What have we learned, and what would we be prepared for if a second outbreak were to hit? My next guest is here to give us an update. John Cohen is a staff writer for Science Magazine based in Cardiff by the Sea, California. Give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. John Cohen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
First of all, Liberia did discharge its last Ebola patient in hospital care, but there was a report of a sick fisherman bringing Ebola back. What's the status of the outbreak right now?
So the virus is in three countries, and Liberia is one of those three. It's not over till it's over, and it requires, by international health standards, 42 days of no one having a confirmed case before you can say that it's over. Both Guinea and Sierra Leone, which are neighboring countries, still have active cases and contacts are being traced.
What's the central challenge that you see in getting to zero cases and to actually getting this problem solved?
From the onset of the outbreak, it's been finding people who have the active cases and finding their contacts and testing them. That's been the problem all along.
Many drug treatments and clinical trials are fast-tracked, including something called ZMAP. We've talked on the program about some of these potential trials. Has production on that drug been ramped up? Has it been approved for use in humans so far?
Production has increased. It has yet to be formally evaluated in a study that proves whether it works. So, no, it's not approved for widespread use, but a trial is underway, taking place both in Liberia and in the United States as well.
When we say production has increased, I mean, how many doses are we talking about here?
Well, the company that makes it was out of the product altogether come the end of the year. So there were zero doses available. Now there are around 50 is the latest figure I've heard. And 50 doses could lead to an answer as to whether it works or not.
Is ZMAP the potential drug that shows the most promise right now?
In monkey studies, absolutely. It worked remarkably well. But monkeys aren't humans, and there can be problems that surface. Side effects can surface when things go into humans. And there's another drug called TKM Ebola that's made by a company called Techmira that equally looked promising in monkeys, although when tested in some small human studies, it had some side effects that gave people pause.
What are some other drugs that have been put into trials that are showing some promise?
There's a drug called favipiravir that's an influenza drug marketed in Japan, and it's been tested in Guinea, and the reports from that study are that in people who show up at the clinic fairly healthy, it appears that there's some signal that the drug helped them. The study has been criticized for its design because it doesn't have a randomized control group. So in other words, you can't compare someone who came to the clinic who received the drug and someone who came to the clinic on the same day and didn't receive the drug.
And why is that? Explain a bit more.
There's an ethical problem. For a lot of doctors working with a highly lethal disease like Ebola, they don't want to randomize someone to a control group when they have a potentially helpful drug. So even though they don't know the drug works, they don't feel it's ethically right to use that sort of design. Other clinicians and researchers argue just the opposite, that it's the most ethical thing to do because that leads to an answer the most quickly, and you don't know whether the product works to begin with. So you're in what they call equipoise.
And this very important, I was just going to say, this important question has been handled differently in different places with different drugs, and that's causing part of the confusion here.
It's been an incredibly emotional issue, and it has dragged out and delayed the launch of trials, that's for sure. And there are people who argue that the favipiravir study that took place has clouded things because you have some promising-looking data that may or may not be true. So there's a great divide between the worlds here, and the most passionate people who are arguing against doing these sort of controlled studies are the doctors who are at the front and have been treating patients. So they have a strong moral argument backing their perspective.
We're getting an update on the Ebola outbreak with John Cohen, a staff writer for Science Magazine. If you want to call us, 844-724-8255, that's 844-SCI-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us at SciFry. If you'd like to find out more about what we're going to be talking about this hour, go to sciencefriday.com. You'll find links to our topic. GlaxoSmithKline has said that they could have millions of doses of an experimental vaccine ready by April of this year. Is that vaccine or other experimentals on track right now, John?
Yeah, so just to finish up with the drug stuff, because I think people confuse drugs and vaccines. Drugs are meant to help people who have the virus in their bodies. The vaccine is meant to prevent the virus from ever getting a foothold in someone's body. So in the drug realm, that favipiravir study in Guinea is ongoing. That's continuing. One drug study with a drug called brincidofovir was stopped because the U.S. company that makes it didn't want the trial to continue. It's not really clear why it was stopped, but I think we can gather that it wasn't working. And there's also a trial going on in Guinea and probably elsewhere with convalescent serum. That means taking blood from somebody who recovered from Ebola and pulling that blood out and putting it into another person who has a matching blood type to see if the antibodies can help them. So that's similar to ZMapp, which is a concoction of antibodies. So that's the drug realm. You had asked about vaccines.
Yeah.
There are two vaccines that are being tested. One is made by GSK and the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and the other is made by a collaboration between a small biotech from Iowa called NewLink and the large pharmaceutical Merck.
So we're still waiting for a drug treatment, and we're still not sure when we might see a drug treatment that we know is effective. So in the absence of this, we're looking at things like rapid diagnostic testing for Ebola. Has a really good test been developed so far?
You need a good test regardless of whether you have drugs or vaccines, because that's the way you get people into isolation and you stop spread of the virus. So that's central to containment efforts. The standard test for Ebola uses a high-tech machine that's PCR, that is like a photocopier of DNA or genetic material, and it's hard to set up labs in West Africa that have PCR machines. It's been done. They're working, but it's technically a challenge. There is a new diagnostic that relies on Ebola antibodies. It's not as predictive of whether someone truly is infected, but it's pretty good, and it's much faster and cheaper. So eventually, what the world will need is a faster, simpler, cheaper diagnostic. And then that will allow identifying and isolating infected people more quickly.
What about measuring the quantity of Ebola levels in patients' blood?
Extremely tricky. So there is no validated test that can say, hey, you've got this many viruses in a milliliter of blood. We have that for many diseases. If you have an HIV infection, you can go to your doctor and find out just how much virus you have in your body. But in the case of Ebola, instead of that, they rely on how many times the PCR machine has to cycle, make copies in order to detect the virus, which is a crude measure of quantity. you know it takes 20 cycles to detect the virus. Well, there's more virus there than if it took 40 cycles. But, you know, that's not very precise. And when you're evaluating the impact of a drug in particular, you really want to know precisely how much virus someone has when they enter the clinic, because we know from really good studies that that determines your likelihood of dying from this disease.
Mm. With all of these threads that we have to chase down, do you have a sense of where most of the money is being focused right now, finding treatments, whether it's drugs or vaccines, looking for diagnostics? I mean, where's the money going and where do you think the money should be going?
Well, the primary thing to do is to help people who have the disease. And I think the bulk of the money is going toward that level of care and contact tracing, which are very, very expensive, labor-intensive things to do. And safe burials also are critical and cost money. The drug and vaccine research funding is a small percentage of the overall investment in helping these countries that have had destroyed infrastructures. I mean, these are countries that had to close their hospitals. They had to close their schools. They fell apart. I think we sometimes forget how very devastating this epidemic was at its peak and how much it disrupted those already fragile countries.
Mm-hmm. And should we feel that the peak has passed and that now this is something that we have under control in these countries, or should we feel as though this is maybe an ongoing problem that could be with us for quite some time?
Well, I think just remember how this began. It first infected a child in Guinea in December of 2013. It wasn't detected until March. It then, by April of 2014, by the end of April, it looked like it had gone away. We can easily be fooled by this virus. And anyone who says it's time to uncork the champagne, they're kidding themselves. We're in the midst of something that's highly lethal and is transmitted readily, and it's not over till it's over.
Thank you very much for the update. John Cohen is a staff writer for Science Magazine based in Cardiff-by-the-Sea, California. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we're going to talk about a mysterious polio-like paralysis that has been seen in some children here in the U.S. That's coming up next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Last fall, a respiratory virus was making the rounds, causing coughs and sniffles in kids around the country. But about 100 of these children were experiencing something more severe, a polio-like paralysis in their arms and legs. The virus, called enterovirus D68, isn't new, but the paralysis hasn't been associated with it before. The number of cases has fallen off since October, but doctors are still baffled by what exactly caused this paralysis. My next guest is here to walk us through what we do know. Terry Schreiner is an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Colorado in Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And if you have questions about this mysterious ailment, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So, Terry, what is enterovirus D68?
Well, enterovirus D68 is not a new virus. It's a virus that we've known about for several decades. But up until recently, it was a virus that we thought was not causing many problems, namely respiratory infections. That changed at the end of this summer into fall of 2014 when the respiratory illness associated with enterovirus D68 really blossomed, and it was throughout the country causing very significant upper respiratory infections.
So this virus, it's in the same family as polio. What do we know about the similarities, differences?
Well, The enterovirus D68 is one of over 100 different kinds of enterovirus that were in the same family, the picornavirus family, that contain poliovirus as well as other viruses like enterovirus 71 that is known to cause weakness after infection. So it has a nefarious family, which I think has led some to question whether or not, in fact, the enterovirus D68 is responsible for the weakness that we have seen in these children. And that causality has not yet been proven.
Describe these unusual symptoms to us a little bit more, if you would.
Of course. So in Colorado, we recognized a cluster of cases, children, who presented in August and September through October with very distinctive findings. And they included weakness of one or more of their limbs that was clinically distinct. The limb was weak. It was limp. There was loss of deep tendon reflexes. And importantly, there was preserved sensation, so no difficulty feeling in the affected limb. The children also had, in many cases, weakness of the muscles of their face and mouth, and they had very distinct findings on MRI of their spine and their brainstem. And it was this constellation of symptoms, the weakness in particular, the brainstem findings, the weakness of the muscles of the face and mouth, and the distinctive MRI features that really allowed us to recognize this as a distinct syndrome.
And what did you see on their MRIs, aside from just the symptoms?
Right. Well, MRI is an imaging technique that we use to look at the central nervous system in neurology. And what we look for are signs of inflammation, signs that there is something different going on in regions of the brain and the brain stem. And what we found in these children was there was a signal change. There was evidence of some type of inflammation going on in what we call the ventral gray matter, the front part of the spinal cord in the area where we see, where we know the anterior horn cells, the cell bodies that control the nerves, that control movement, live. And that was quite distinct and atypical from what we usually see when we see inflammation in the spinal cord.
So now what information would you need to show some definitive proof that links this virus with these very unusual symptoms that you've seen in really just a few dozen children?
Well, and that is what we are working on right now, because what we know is that there were two outbreaks occurring at the same time, the outbreak of enterovirus D68 causing the respiratory illness and the outbreak of the syndrome that we're calling acute flaccid myelitis, namely the weakness with the distinctive MRI features. And what we're trying to do now is establish that one caused the other. And we're doing that through several means. One is putting together a large case control study in which we look at the children that were affected by acute flaccid myelitis and children who had the enterovirus D68 respiratory infection but did not have the acute flaccid myelitis, and try and figure out what is different about them. We're also looking at the virus and trying to sequence that virus to understand how it is similar and different to its family members, namely other enteroviruses within this family and poliovirus, which is known to cause a similar clinical picture. So that is work that is ongoing. We're also looking at the children who were affected by acute flaccid myelitis to understand why they were affected with the acute flaccid myelitis when their siblings and other family members who may have had the same respiratory illness did not develop the acute flaccid myelitis.
Yeah. And does that point to some sort of genetic cause?
Well, that's the work that is underway, is looking at the genetic material of the children affected and of their siblings, and going through and really taking a comprehensive look at the DNA, comparing it, and then seeing what is similar and what is different.
You know, we've been talking an awful lot about vaccines in America recently and the magic of the polio vaccine. Is there any sense that a child that had a polio vaccine might in some ways be protected from something like this?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have any evidence of that. So of the 12 cases that were seen in our institution, 11 of them were fully vaccinated, including against polio. And that is something that the CDC is evaluating on the other 100 children reported throughout the country. But to my knowledge, there's not been any suggestion that they're that the absence of a polio vaccine is associated with this illness, this syndrome. Now, that being said, we're still very much in favor of vaccinating against polio and against other preventable illnesses. So that's, you know, we want to advocate for that and continue vaccinations. But unfortunately, the vaccinations that we have are not preventing this illness right now.
So when you have a mystery like this, what comes next? What's the next thing you have to wait for or look for?
Well, I think one of the questions that is posed to me most often from family members is, what does this mean? What does this mean for my child who can no longer move their left arm or who has difficulty walking because of a weak leg? And that is a difficult question to answer because we suspect that this syndrome, acute flaccid myelitis, has been present before. This is not a brand new phenomenon, but we are seeing it in much greater numbers and thus recognize it to be distinct and to be a separate entity. But we don't have enough information about prior cases of acute flaccid myelitis to really project and say, in 1 year, your child is going to look like this. In 2 years, your child will look like that, and so forth. So one of the things that we're focusing on is, first of all, providing as much support to the families and the patients as possible in terms of psychosocial and emotional health, but also physical therapy, occupational therapy, and really following the children closely to see if we can maximize their recovery and help them to recover from this illness.
And that's what I want to ask about last. How are they doing? How are the kids that you've seen doing now?
Well, what we've seen is that in the short term following the presentation, following the weakness, the kids have made improvements. Unfortunately, they're not getting back to their pre-illness baseline, so before the weakness set in. We're not seeing them get back to that state. And it's somewhat discouraging, I think, for us as well as for families. But we're trying to remain optimistic. And I think that we will learn from them. It's only been, you know, 6 months or so since this has really been recognized, and so there is still a possibility for improvement. But it's been so far a very slow fought and gradual improvement.
Mm. Well, I wish you a lot of success in your search for this, and I wish the best of the families. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Terry Schreiner is an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Colorado in Denver. In the Ordovician period, some 443 to 485 million years ago or so, life was different. This week in the journal Nature, a paper describes a fossil found in Morocco of one of the largest arthropods ever found, a creature related to modern insects and crustaceans that reached over 2 meters long. But before you have nightmares about some massive centipede thing attacking you the next time you go to the beach, it was a filter feeder, kind of like a whale, no nasty teeth or claws. Peter Van Roy, co-author of that paper and a paleontologist at Yale University, joins me to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
But first of all, describe this creature for us. What did it look like?
Well, it's an animal to our eyes. It looks incredibly weird. In fact, it has this three-part head shield, and the median part is incredibly long. It accounts for about half the length of the animal, and the shield actually sticks out in front of the head. And then you have two oval side shields, which sit next to the head. The head itself has this pair of segmented appendages. In most creatures of this group, which is called Animalocharidids, most creatures in this group use these head appendages to capture prey, their active predators. Now, in our animal, these appendages, they have this very elaborate network of spines, and these appendages are used for the filter feeding. Then the body is broad and flat, and it carries actually two sets of flaps on the side. Lower set of flaps was used for swimming, the upper for stabilization. And across the trunk, on each segment, you have gills that run across the back, and they actually attach at the base of the upper flaps. And so it's an absolutely strange-looking beast.
So what can you tell me about these flaps? What's so important about them?
Well, actually, they provide crucial insight into the early evolution of arthropod appendages. And if you look at a modern arthropod appendage in its most basic form, this appendage actually has two branches. You have a lower branch and an upper branch, and each of these can be modified or even lost to suit a specific purpose. And so the lower branch often can be a walking leg, which they just use to walk around, and the upper branch quite often is used as a gill. Now, the main question has always been, like, how did these two-branched limbs arise? And what our animal actually shows is that these two pairs of flaps that we have in this animal, the lower set of flaps, they are actually modified legs, modified limbs. The upper set of flaps, they are, and so this lower set of flaps, this is equivalent to the lower branch of a modern arthropod limb. This upper set of flaps is equivalent to the upper branch. But in our animal, these two structures, they are still separate. They still sit in separate parts on the body, in separate areas on the body. And so they show that our animal, it predates the formation of this double-branched limb. It shows a phase in the formation of this limb. You already have the two branches, but they haven't fused yet at the base. They're still separate structures on the body.
What an interesting-looking creature you have here.
it's absolutely bizarre, and actually even the whole group of animal acarids, they're really strange-looking animals, but ours looks even for an animal acarid, it's weird.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, if you say arthropod, most arthropods I think of, though, are hard-shelled, something like a lobster, but this had kind of a squishy body?
Yes, the only hard parts it basically had were this head shield and the frontal appendages. These would have been relatively hard. The rest of the body, most of the animal, is completely soft. And this is another thing. It's a very, very early arthropod. It's very early in the evolution. It predates the acquisition of a completely hard exoskeleton. So it would have been a largely soft animal, and that also makes it really exceptional to have a fossil like this, because obviously these things normally they do not fossilize. It's very, very rare to get something like that fossilized.
So how rare is it that it was a filter feeder, kind of like some very large whales?
Well, it's among animal acarids, it's extremely rare. Other animal acarids, they are active predators. They would go after their prey. They would grab it with these frontal appendages. There's only one filter feeding animal acarid that has been described before. It's an older form. It's about 530 million years old. But it's a much smaller animal. It was about 50 centimeters, which is still sizable for the time, but a lot smaller than our animal. And also the filter feeding appendages, they are much less sophisticated, and it used actually a very inefficient way of filter feeding. It would just rake its appendages constantly through the water, hoping to trap some small particles, which of course is very energy expensive. Whereas our animal, it has this much more sophisticated filter feeding apparatus, and it would just swim and drag this through the water basically as a net, and it would capture particles. So it's a much more advanced animal. And the main thing also is, of course, that our animal, it's huge, it's humongous. It's the biggest individuals reached over 2 meters in size, which makes it one of the biggest arthropods to have ever lived.
And that is quite frightening to think about. Before I let you go, I have to ask you, how did it get its name? What did you name this thing?
So we named it Aegirocassis benmulai. And so Aegir is, in Norse mythology, is a giant and a god of the sea. So we thought that was quite fitting for an animal that size, a marine animal. Aegir is also a very old being. Our animal is about 480 million years old, so that's quite fitting. Cassis is Latin for helmet. And that's, of course, a reference to this very elaborate head shield. And then benmulai is actually after the man who discovered this fossil and the entire fauna, this exceptionally preserved fauna, which is called the Fezouata biota. And he's a local Moroccan collector. I've been working with him for the past 12 years. And he's just absolutely amazing. He has been supporting our research. And basically, without him, we wouldn't be talking here today. We would simply not know that this animal existed. And so this man really deserves a lot of credit. And that's why we named the animal after him.
Well, it's a very nice thing to do indeed. Peter Van Roy is an associate research scientist in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Yale University, co-author of a paper describing a fossil giant arthropod in this week's Nature. Thank you so much for sharing this creature with us today.
Thank you.
When we come back, now you can sign up for a clinical trial on your smartphone, but how safe is your medical data? Stay with us for that. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Earlier this week, Apple announced something called Research Kit, a software platform that doctors and developers can use to tap into data on your iPhone that it collects about your health. Stuff like how fast you walk, your gait, the sound of your voice, your reaction time to stimulus on the screen, how well you breathe. And don't worry, you have to opt in to share this data, as many thousands of people already have. In fact, this sign-up-by-smartphone method has given doctors a pool of patients bigger than they've ever had before, very quickly. But are we ready to conduct huge population-wide clinical trials via smartphone? My next guest wrote about a few of the ethical conundrums facing this digital data-gathering campaign this week in The Verge. Ariel Duhaime-Ross is a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
And if you have thoughts about this, you can call us 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So first of all, give us a thumbnail sketch. What exactly is in this research kit?
Yeah, so Research Kit is a software platform. Essentially what it does is that it allows researchers, developers, to make an app that is specific to a study that, you know, whatever institution, a clinic or a university is conducting. And then they can put it on the App Store, and people can opt into this trial. They can download the app, and they can start participating in the trial. Now, what's interesting about Research Kit is that it lets you tap into the sensors in your phone, like you just talked about. So whatever, you know, the accelerometers that are in the phone, and it lets you kind of access that, which was something that Apple was very protective of in the has been very protective of in the past. So that's one of the major differences. And yeah, it's so you can conduct real studies.
When I went searching on my phone for Research Kit, it didn't give me one thing. It showed up a couple different apps from different medical organizations. What are some of the apps that are out there right now?
Well, right now there are only five. Research Kit hasn't yet been released. It'll be released next month to developers, so institutions will be able to create their own apps. But in advance of the announcement, Apple started working with, you know, gave access to a few institutions like Stanford, Mount Sinai is participating. And the apps that are there right now, there's one for asthma, there's one for cardiovascular health, there's one for Parkinson's disease, and there's one for breast cancer. There's a fifth one that I'm forgetting right now.
And obviously, we've had for a few years apps that will track different parts of your health, and that's something that's become fairly common now. But these are different. These are enrolling you in a clinical trial. I mean, explain a little bit more.
Right. So they enroll you in a clinical trial, and really what it does is that the data that they're gathering, some of it is survey questions that you're answering. It's not just whatever your phone is picking up on your movements. But it really has to do with your health, your well-being, and that information is being sent to researchers so they can analyze it and, you know, essentially publish studies from that.
So is it a stand-in for some other app that might be able to take information about my personal data, or is this something that's really specifically about heart health? And, you know, if that's the app, and that's going to just trace certain data for me.
Yeah, it can be very specific. They're not, you know, picking up on, for heart health, for instance, it's stuff like how much you walk around, what your movements are. For Parkinson's disease, they also have things like trying to make you do certain things with your hands to test your tremors, to test your accuracy. So these are things that are very disease specific.
I want to bring in another guest who worked on some of these new health apps. John Wilbanks is a chief commons officer at Sage Bionetworks in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday, John.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about some of the apps that you worked on.
So Sage Bionetworks, which is a nonprofit research organization, it's actually based in Seattle, although I'm here, created two of the five apps. We created the Parkinson's app that Ariel referenced earlier, as well as an app for women who are in recovery from chemotherapy to measure the impact of chemotherapy on cognition.
We heard about this Parkinson's app, and you know, as we talk about some of the ethics of this in just a moment, one of the things that's just remarkable is so far you've already had more people sign up for a Parkinson's trial through this app than you've ever really had sign up for a Parkinson's trial ever anywhere.
That's certainly what it looks like, you know, and we're still learning how to read the numbers. But it's been amazing when you look because we provide some server technologies across the five apps. And when you look at Parkinson's, it's easily we think it's going to be the largest in history. By the time we're done, we're approved for 20,000. We'd like to get that bigger. But you know, within about 72 hours across the five apps, we had about 37,000 accounts created. So we're feeling really good about that part, right? Those aren't, you know, Angry Birds numbers, but that's not what we're looking for.
So, I don't know, Ariel, is this the first time the clinical trials have ever been done anything like this before?
Well, there have been clinical trials run on phones before, on phone apps. I guess one of the big differences is one is how large the Apple audience is and how accessible this is. You can literally just go into the App Store, you can, you know, look up ResearchKit, and then the five apps pop up. The other big difference is that at no point do the researchers, unless you know somebody asks a specific question and emails the people who are running the trial, at no point do the researchers really have direct contact with the people who are in the trial, the participants. So the screening process is all through the phone, and that is one of the major differences.
And that really is one of the criticisms of this, John, is without that direct doctor contact, it's a very different sort of trial, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, and this is the part that I worked on the most. So, you know, I'm happy to chat about it. We started by asking ourselves this question. We got a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation a couple of years ago to look at how to connect large groups of patients to their data and then to connect those enacted, enabled patients to networks of people who could analyze that data. That's what we do. And as we started looking at how communities did health tracking and how communities, what communities of patients really wanted, it became clear that the only place we were going to get the sort of data that we wanted from a scientific perspective was from people's pockets, from something they carried with them. And so, you know, Parkinson's is a good example. You would have, you'd go to the hospital once a year and get a phone call twice a year. So the way that we came to the consent process for this was by saying, if we're going to get into people's phones, we can run the same tests that you used to run once a year, 52 times a year. We can ask the same questions you ask twice a year, 52 times a year. And so the ability to get that sample size, as well as the ability, as Ariel mentioned, to get to the reach of a smartphone population, put the challenge in front of us of figuring out how to do informed consent. So we worked with the Electronic Data Methods Forum, which is funded by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. We ran a couple of workshops. We did dozens and dozens of interviews, released preliminary versions, and sort of worked our way towards a form of informed consent that we think is at least as good as the existing encounter, which is basically a clinician handing a long legal document to a patient and saying, sign here.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, and if you have questions about these new apps that track your health and enroll you in clinical trials, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Do these apps, Ariel, need approval by institutional review boards as like a normal study would?
Right. So normal studies do. They do need IRB approval, which is the institutional review board. It's a review board that will make sure that, you know, the benefits of conducting the study will outweigh the risks of, you know, whatever risks a study participant might have. It's also something that, you know, takes a look at the ethics. And yes, every single app that is right now has been released has IRB approval. What's interesting is that, 3 days after the release, Apple released guidelines for app approval, and there is no mention of IRB. So that to me is you know kind of an issue. Obviously, the people who are doing this, people who are at Stanford University, people who are at Mount Sinai, that is a critical step, and they would never release an app without IRB approval. But I am wondering, you know, what if an institution that is maybe a little bit less careful about these types of things, you know, a body that doesn't care so much, what if they submit an app? It's not in the Apple's guidelines. So that is worrisome to me.
John, do you have a thought on that?
I think it's a very fair point. I mean, IRB approval is not the end-all be-all of being ethical, right? There's a lot of other things that go into running an ethical kind of study, and a lot of those are new in the mobile world. But I think starting with IRB as a you know, you want that on the checklist first, right? That shows you did your homework, you talked to an independent group. It forces you into a different context. I can tell you that working with developers who are used to working in the consumer world and working them through what it's like to work with an IRB was an experience in itself. And I think that's a really important part of the experience, because the whole idea is these are a different kind of apps. These are not apps that are out to hoover up your data and make it easier to sell you sweaters. You know, these are really trying to engage you in a new kind of doing research. And you know, making sure that we have some external independent review of that is critical to the process for me.
Rachel in Birmingham, Alabama has one of the questions that I think we want to ask here. Rachel, go ahead. You're on the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, is the sample affected by the fact that only certain people can afford the iPhone or the newest iPhone? And, I mean, what does that do to the data when you exclude, I guess, poor people who can't really afford that?
I think it's a great question. John, you want to tackle that?
Sure. It's a great question, and it's a great point. It's sort of the reality, and it's the reality of any kind of smartphone-driven study. When you look at, you know, distribution of phones, all smartphones are economically stratifying at a certain level. You know, the sad thing is that so is medical research. You know, a 2013 FDA report that came out pointed out that basically it was white people representing a large portion of clinical trial study participants. And so I think that the demographic population of iPhone owners is probably more diverse than the demographic of existing clinical study populations to start with. And then the second thing is that this is an argument that other smartphone operating system manufacturers ought to be allowing this kind of work to happen on their phones too. You know, it's really hard to do this with Android because of all of the structural variations on their platforms. And when ResearchKit shows up open source next month, you know, I sincerely hope that we see people coming and porting it so that it works on Android. Because we want one of the potentials of this is to really open up the diversity of these studies to where they represent, you know, the real economic, genetic diversity of a population. And up until now, we just haven't been able to get there.
Ariel?
I think John is right in the sense that, yes, it will probably, you know, just already there are so many people who have signed up for these studies. And, you know, he rightly points out that is an incredible difference compared to what we've seen in the past. And in that sense, yes, perhaps we will get a more diverse population. iPhone users, correct, you know, the caller said iPhone users are more affluent, so that is probably an issue. It won't, you know, the burden of disease is bigger in people who are, for certain diseases, is bigger in people who are poorer. But again, John points out that right now clinical trials are already on campuses. What I would say is that the speed at which people have agreed already to sign on for these studies is another worrisome factor, because it means these people are extremely engaged in their diseases. And that is not a problem in and of itself. The problem is that their behaviors are probably not representative of the entire population that has these diseases. So that's a population bias. There's, you know, there are people who are willing to take steps to improve their health, and therefore that might really skew the results of a number of these studies.
I just want to tell our listeners that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We want to go to a quick phone call here from Ben, who's in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a quick question. I might have missed it earlier in the conversation, but people who participate in these studies, for the Parkinson's study in particular, how do you know that they actually have Parkinson's?
We don't. We ask them. You know, if you were doing a study with 1,700 people, it's really important to make sure that they each fit the eligibility criteria really, really precisely. We ask people yes or no. If someone wants to lie and enroll and spend, you know, an hour a week impersonating someone with Parkinson's, then that's going to show. But the odds are that the sort of the longitudinal data that comes out is going to be a pretty clear outlier, both from the controls and from the Parkinson's samples. So the expectation is that we should be able to quantitatively identify a lot of that as outlier data, and be able to manage it. You know, every study has you know, has sample bias issues, and it has data management issues, and it has, you know, these kinds of questions. But this is different in that, you know, there is not a doctor looking at you going and saying, you have Parkinson's, you're going to enroll in this. Oh. We are trusting people to tell us the truth.
We just have 30 seconds left, Ariel, but who has access to this data? That's the other last question lingering.
Right. Well, actually, the people who have access to the data are the people who are running the studies. And those, but, you know, it could also, people have to opt in and have to say, you know, I don't mind that my data will be shared with a third party, probably another group of researchers. So they have to they have control over that, and they have to opt into that. My question is, will some other groups, not the groups that are doing it right now, because they've assured me that they wouldn't, will some other groups sell this data to pharmaceutical companies? Will pharmaceutical companies want to make apps themselves? There's another issue that I wanted to put in that is, it's very easy to lie about your age. And for instance, for the asthma study, the kids who are under 18, they're not supposed to take part in that study, any of the studies really, because they're supposed to have parental approval. And I was able to lie about my age, say I was under 18, I pressed on the back button, and then I was able to get into the study.
So maybe still some kinks to work out, but also some very interesting stuff that we can learn. I want to thank Ariel Duhaime-Ross, who's a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Thanks so much for coming in. John Wilbanks is Chief Commons Officer at Sage BioNetworks in Washington. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go, the architect and designer Michael Graves died this week. He gave form to many prominent postmodern buildings, but also became known for his design of a line of kitchenwares, from spatulas to tea kettles, that you could buy at Target. Ira spoke with him in 2002 about his philosophy of design in those everyday household objects.
Well, I mean, it's probably hard to attach the kind of idea of humanism to these everyday objects, but it is that. In fact, it's the kind of thing where you pick something up or use it with a little bit of joy, actually. It puts a smile on your face.
That's Michael Graves back in 2002 on our show. He was 80 years old. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of this program, point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. And we have a new article and video up on our website on how perfume is made. Our web producer, Chow Tu, went to Los Angeles to mix up Science Friday's signature scent.
This recipe has 10 drops of orange blossom, 1 drop of bergamot, 10 drops of violet, 5 drops of rose accord, 10 drops of white musky, and 12 drops of ethyl vanilla bigon. It's Sci-Fry's signature scent as much as I imagined it to be. In the end, it kind of just smelled like vanilla.
Check out her feature at sciencefriday.com/perfume. Smells like science. Ira will be back next week. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.